Just a note about the ending there. It's kind of interesting. I'm not sure where it comes from. I doubt that it's actually the Buddha's words, but it's funny and surprising sometimes to find out where these things come from, these chants that have been passed down, and they're not directly from the Tipitaka. But it's funny where you find them sometimes later on, and you say, "Oh, that's where it came from this commentary or that commentary." I just found something this morning in relation to this ongoing legal battle I'm having this morning with another Buddhist organization. No, it hasn't. It isn't. That's an hyperbole, I think. But this wrinkle in the fabric of the Buddhist organization, which I find funny, which is probably wrong of me, but it's quite humorous. But while I was looking up exactly what was said in this book in regards to such things as copyright, I found something that my teacher had taught us time and time again about death. And I never knew where he got this from, and it's something that I've used since then. When we talk about death and when people ask about rebirth, and it's something that my teacher would often tell new meditators on the second or third day of their practice, is that there are three kinds of death. This is the conceptual, and all three of these types should be understood as part of the Buddha's teaching. I think we miss one or the other of them. There are many literalists who, I don't know if literalists, there are different kinds of literalists, I think. There are the traditionalists who think of death only as a conceptual thing, and so they think of Buddhism as something that you use to get a good rebirth, in the sense of when this body breaks apart, the mind will be reborn into another body. And it will be a good one if you've practiced the Dhamma. And then there are the literalists, I guess, better understood as literalists, who refuse this and say that's just a Hindu concept that has nothing to do with the Buddha's teaching. It was just something that the Buddha used as kind of like a simile or a metaphor. But actually, death is something that occurs on a moment-to-moment basis. And death in Buddhism should be understood as moment to moment. The Buddha never taught about, this is what they say, the Buddha never taught about the death of the body and being reborn. But what the Buddha meant by rebirth was rebirth moment to moment, from moment to moment. Which actually isn't being very literalist at all, because there are many parts of the Buddha's teaching that are that are definitely references to the rebirth of the being, as it were. Though I don't even think the word rebirth is used, but it's described very technically. But the point being that this process of birth and death at every moment doesn't stop at the moment of physical death; it continues on. Except unless there, for as long as there is clinging, because it is clinging. Oh, no problem. Sorry, I missed the. No problem. Come anytime. Just drop in. We're here. It's okay. We might be changing the time as well. Maybe we'll have a little huddle or something afterwards to talk about changing the time. Anyway, to continue. So to say that the Buddha didn't talk about this concept of rebirth, or the implication is that the Buddha didn't teach concepts at all, which is totally false. The Buddha taught in many different ways, and we should never This is why probably the worst thing that I come across is when a teacher or a student tries to say that the Buddha taught only this or only that. And they bring up these Buddhist texts that they say imply that. And I was thinking about this yesterday because it's such an absurdity to say that a 2,500-year-old text implies something. When you don't even know if the text literally says what the Buddha literally said, what the Buddha himself said, you don't even, you know, 2,500 years is a long time, and it could easily have been made up, it could have been distorted, and we always give the benefit of the doubt that it wasn't made up, and probably wasn't distorted, except, you know, slightly. We'll give the benefit of the doubt there. But we'll give some leeway that it may have been distorted over time. But the only way I would ever say that something had been made up was if you could give me greatly substantial proof that it had been made up. I like to give the text the benefit of the doubt, because of course, as well, this isn't the biggest deal or the most import. Whether the text actually say this or that, the Buddhist teaching is truth, and we're learning the truth. So here we have overall a very good practice for coming to understand the truth, and that's most important. And once you understand the truth, then you'll be able to see where all of the Buddhist teachings fit in, and you'll see that it paints a fairly big picture. So anyway, so what I found was this teaching on the three kinds of death, and it turns out that I don't know where else it might come from, but it's in the Buddha Gosupati, I believe is the name, the story of Buddha Gosa, which is like a legend or a story based on a commentary, based on a collection that is based on commentaries. So it's quite sub, and it may come from something a little more authentic, but now at least I know where that came from and where he got it from. And you know, it doesn't matter to me that it's not canonical, it's obviously something that the Buddha taught in perhaps in a different form, and perhaps the Buddha's form was better or more clear, but something that works and works quite well when talking to meditators. It helps us to understand the nature of reality, the nature of our experience in the meditation. That actually that death, when a body dies, is only conceptual. And the true death is at every moment. This is death in an ultimate sense. Because at every moment, who we are dies. And it's only through actually looking at experience that you can come to see this, and you come to see that a thought arises and ceases, and that thought disappeared. It isn't still hanging on, or it hasn't been transformed into something else. Even though it may have given rise to something after it, the thought itself is gone. When we have experiences, those experiences arise and cease. When we feel pleasure and pain, when we're angry and upset, these things arise and cease. They don't continue on. And this is the illusion that we break when we start to practice in meditation. The third kind of death that it mentions, this is actually totally unrelated to what I began talking about, but it's interesting. The third kind of death is in regards to the death of defilement. And this is the death that we are striving for in Buddhism. So someone once complained to the Buddha, or insulted the Buddha, he said, "So what, you're a nihilist?" And the Buddha said, yes, you could say I'm a nihilist. There is a way that it would be proper to say that I'm a nihilist, in the sense that I call for the annihilation, without remainder, of evil thoughts, evil deeds, of greed, anger, and delusion, of all unwholesome states. And so again and again, this guy tried to call him this and call him that, and the Buddha said, yes, I'm a destroyer in the sense that I call for the destruction of the evil states and so on. And so this is when we talk about death in Buddhism, because the mind and body complex continues on ad infinitum. The only real death is when the mind gives this up and lets it go, and when the defilements cease. Because this stream of consciousness and of experience is perpetuated by craving, by clinging. And for as long as we cling, we will continue to be reborn and develop more and more sankhara or formations. We'll keep building things. When we die, we'll cling and seek out another body, wanting to get this and wanting to get that. Even during life, we will continue to create clinging and attachment. So the true death is when there is no more defilement. That's what the death that the Buddha called for. And this was a very important way of framing his teaching, because people had all sorts of philosophical ideas about nihilism and the annihilation of the soul and nibbana as being somehow nihilistic or so on. That somehow the goal that the Buddha talked about was totally undesirable. So the Buddha framed it in this way, which was quite, of course, among other things, was quite clever, because you can't argue with that. You can, but a spiritual person would have a hard time arguing against giving up defilements, giving up greed, giving up anger, giving up delusion. Now, ordinary people have no problem arguing against these things, and often do. Oh, you want me to give up anger? But anger is so important. Let people walk all over me? I'm like, yeah, let them walk all over you. Or, you want to get me to give up my enjoyment of life? For people who have not yet, generally have not yet experienced some catastrophe, some breakdown in the logic of their existence, who still hold on to a false logic and are rewarded with the seeming cohesion of that argument. You know, for a person who says, all you have to do is think positively and good things will happen to you. And then, because of good things that they've done in the past, good things happen to them, and so they think, yeah, this is right. Until they start thinking positive and then bad things happen to them. Or a person who says, all I have to do is follow after God, and God will protect me. And as long as good things happen to them, and when they pray to God, then good things happen, then they think, yes, this is the truth. And they look at people who are very spiritual, who say this or that, and those people also have good karma, and so good things happen to them, and so on. But when this breaks down, when our current belief system doesn't support or isn't supported by reality, isn't carried out by reality. And there are many ways this can occur. When we can see other people suffering, people who are good people suffering, when someone we love suffers, when we ourselves start to suffer. We often talk about how this is what leads people to the Dhamma, is suffering. But it's not exactly suffering. It doesn't mean that only miserable people come to practice meditation. It means people who question and people who are seeking, because they are unable to find a system of beliefs, a system of practice that is in line with their experience, that is supported by the experiences that they've had. For many people, for some people this is not a problem and they're able to delude themselves continuously and reaffirm their beliefs and adapt them. So you hear people say, well, this is, you know, God will protect me, and then when he doesn't, they say, well, God wants me to learn something, and so on and so on. And eventually it just becomes, we all have our cross to bear, and so on. And this is just as an example. I'm not really trying to be critical, actually just trying to help explain how the whole process works. So this way that the Buddha framed his teaching was in a way that was quite acceptable to people who were already on a spiritual path, who had already begun to question these things, question the status quo, who began to see the problems with addiction, the problems with clinging, who could see the problems with anger and hatred, the problems that these are causing in the world. So this is the teaching of the Buddha's teaching on death. I think it's quite well summed up in this text, and I'm not sure if it comes from something a little more canonical or not, but it certainly is in line with the Buddha's teaching, so I'm willing to accept it. And you can take, for everyone else, you're welcome to just take it as food for thought, as you like. But I brought this up in relation to the text at hand, which is the ending of this ceremony that goes, Imani atta sikha padani silena sugatinyanti silena bhoga sampada silena nibutinyanti tasma silang visodhi. And you've got the translation there in front of you, so should be fairly clear. There are three things that are being discussed here, and as I was saying, I don't know exactly where this comes from, but it's something of a little bit of interest to us on at least a passing level. That virtue leads to three things. First of all, it leads you to happiness. Actually, these should be in the other order, but I think it's just poetic that they happen to be in the order that they are, because in the Buddha's teaching there are three levels of good results. The first is the wealth attained in this life. And the word here is bhoga, which doesn't necessarily mean money. It means material gain. Or it could mean, let's say, probably in this example, it means, in this instance, it means material gain. So it could mean anything material in this world. We're not talking about spiritual gains yet, because spiritual gains can sometimes come at a cost. But here we have that virtue can lead to material gain. Then we have the benefit that it leads to mental gains, as in gains that bring fruit in the next life. So silena sugatingyanti, that it leads us to happiness. Sugating gati means a place that you've gone to. It comes from the root gam, the same as when we say gachami, I go to the Buddha. This is the same word here. Gati is a place that you go to. And in the Buddha's teaching, it generally refers to a place where you go to after you pass away. Su means good, as in sukha, or the sugata. The Buddha is the sugata, one who is gone to goodness, gone in a good way. Sugata. And here we have sugati. Sugati is a place that you go to, a good place that you go to. So it means heaven. It's generally referring to heaven. And then the third one, silena nibutinyanti, leads to liberation. Nibuting. It's an interesting. I have to look exactly where the word nibuting comes from. It's similar to the word nibbana, which comes from nir and varna, I believe. Nir and vana, which is the unbinding. So nibuti. I have to look up where that comes from. But it means the liberation or freedom. So these are three levels that our practice actually has three benefits. leads us to goodness here and now, leads us to goodness in our next life, and it leads us to the ultimate goodness, which is freedom from clinging to our existence, freedom from forming and building and suffering. It leads us to fly free like a bird. And so why I thought this was interesting is because often this seems a bit contradictory, and this seems a little bit out of line with our experience of things. Our experience of reality in the world is generally, you know, good guys finished last, the good die young, and so on. And I was asked by a Sri Lankan man recently why is it that the corrupt people seem to often get ahead in this world? And it's interesting. It's a difficult question to answer, indeed. And here we have something that seems to be contradictory. We seem to see a contradiction that this teaching is not in line with reality. That in fact, at least that second point there, silena bhogga sampada, that to gain wealth you really have to be a crook. And I don't think this is always true, because we see very rich people who don't seem to be very crooked. Now, they may not be totally straight, but they don't seem more crooked than those people who are not getting ahead anyway. In fact, some of them seem to have fairly noble qualities. And it might, in fact, in that sense, it might support the Buddhist teaching that these people, from a Buddhist point of view, may have done something really good in the past. And really, I think that's the answer to that question, is that just how difficult it is to see the exact workings of good deeds. And in fact, the fine print here might be that it might lead to wealth in a future existence or many future existences to come. It might not happen in this life. And that's because we might have very strong karma. It's scientific. We're not talking about something magical. And it's a scientific claim that would be very difficult to prove in a modern scientific standard, because it's not physical. And because it deals with things that can't be measured by physical means. It deals with the mind, which, of course, physical means can't measure directly. But in a scientific sense, it has to follow certain laws, which are that every deed that we've done, every bad and good intention that we've had, has some part to play in the workings of our karma. So there's a cue in that sense, and the good deeds that we do now have to get in line. And it certainly is possible to override past karma with future good, with new, present good karma. This I've seen, appear to have seen. Of course, it's all interpretative. But sometimes when you do really good deeds, suddenly your luck does change. But it has to be some pretty strong good deeds, like starting to practice meditation intensively, giving gifts to holy people, giving great gifts, gifts that require great sacrifice. It can have an impact. It can, in some cases. On the other hand, it may not. But there's another sense in which virtue leads to wealth or leads to material gain, even in this life. It's because of it comes back to how it affects the. Well, it's in many senses, I guess. It is arguable that a person who is virtuous will be respected. And so the problem in today's world isn't exactly in regards to this teaching. It's in regards to the fact that we have really begun to respect, or maybe that's too, maybe it hasn't gotten to that extent, but there is a certain amount of respect in the world for people who are corrupt, which maybe wasn't there in the Buddha's time, not to the extent that it is now, and certainly has repercussions for the general wealth of the human race, that our respect for people who are corrupt, and I guess you see this in some places more than others. I've lived in certain places where it didn't really matter whether the person was corrupt, it just mattered whether they had money and power. And you had to follow after the person who had money and who had power. And when you didn't, it was you who were in the wrong. Any kind of protest was an easy target. And it is an easy target, no? But the idea that somehow leads to wealth is of course very short-sighted, because when you align yourself with corrupt people, bad things happen to you, like in the cases we're seeing now of despots being overthrown. It's quite interesting, it's quite a lesson for us as a human race to see all of these, you know, seemingly invincible dictators being overthrown by, well, I mean, there's many forces at work here, but what seems to be, at least by the waves of samsara, whereas a person who is respectable, there is an argument that it leads them to not be noticed in this way and to not become a target for people's anger. When a person is respectable and acts in modesty, doesn't live outside of their means and doesn't have great ambition, then they're able to live in a fairly peaceful manner, more so than if they were to be unvirtuous. And there are obvious examples of this as well, that people who lead unvirtuous lives, drug dealers or all sorts of people who kill for a living and so on, they can become quite corrupt, and it can lead them to lose business because of their interactions. But more importantly, I was going to say that it affects their mind, that a person who is corrupt will have a difficult time doing business in the end, because the quality of the mind will be severely defiled or will deteriorate as a result of their bad deeds. So that was the only point that I found interesting. I think it's pretty obvious as from a meditator point of view where the other two come from, that good things come to us when our mind is pure and based on our understanding of how this works out in the future, that probably translates into things like heaven or good rebirth, which is actually in many ways a good thing, because being born in heaven or being born in a good rebirth will potentially give great opportunity for the practice of meditation. There was one teacher I heard, he said, don't ever be born as a human being. If you're going to come back as an angel in heaven. Why? Because that's where all the Buddhists are. That's where all the great Buddhists are. If they haven't been released, they haven't become free, then they're still running around up in heaven. And they won't be running around, they'll be sitting around meditating, because they have good minds. And think of what you'll be able to do up in heaven. I think Mahasi Sayadaw says something like how great it is in heaven in a sense, because you can sit still without much suffering, and you could sit still in meditation for months on end if you put your heart into it. Now the problem, of course, is that it seems certain people don't put their hearts into it, and it's possible to become negligent, because heaven can be quite tempting. And there are tricksters. I think Mara is an angel, no? Mara, the evil one, is considered to be one of the angels. So he's up there playing his tricks and tricking people into getting caught up in this and that. And of course our defilements are not eradicated, and so they play a part. So it is often said that being a human is preferable because of the amount of suffering, and it's a reminder to us. Now, I don't know, you take your pick. But the most important here is the third one, nibhutiññanti, that we go to freedom. It doesn't really matter where you're born. The important thing is that you're able to let go. You're not going to cling to your existence. Oh, may I come back in this existence again. Oh, may I not come back in this existence again, and come back in a different existence. You just stop wishing like this. And an arahant, someone asked recently on the Q&A forum about the arahant, and I posted something from Mahasi Sayadaw, which said that they're just like a person who's done their work and is just waiting to get paid. They don't have any more work to do. They've done their work. They're just waiting to be paid, or they don't have any more volition, any more intentions, and so they live their life unconcerned, not thinking, oh, I must do this, I must do that, or may this happen or may that happen, because done is what needs to be done. Katang karaniyang usitang brahmacharing, the holy life has been lived. There's nothing more here to do. So I've gone on quite a bit there. Actually, what I wanted to talk about today was truth, so I'd like to get a little bit into that. As I said earlier, that's really what we're practicing here as Buddhists. That's really what we're concerned with, is the truth. And this is important. We should never be satisfied with belief, with ideas or views. We should never even be satisfied with our acceptance of the Buddha's teaching and our intellectual understanding of it, our ability to regurgitate the Buddha's teaching, our ability to teach. There are several people in our group who are able to explain things in a way that to me makes very good sense. And that's admirable. It's good to see it, and it's a sign that people are actually understanding and practicing. I think it's quite encouraging and heartwarming to see that people find benefit, that what is being passed on is being well received and understood, appreciated, and actually being passed on. It's actually quite remarkable. And this is how the Buddha's teaching has passed on. I mean, my understanding is what I'm passing on is, it's as best I can, what my teacher passed on, and ultimately what the Buddha taught. So to me, it's a good thing. Other people might disagree, but I think it's great to see. But the point is that we shouldn't be satisfied with such things, because often we see that there comes to be hypocrisy, and we should always be reminding ourselves, or looking at ourselves and asking ourselves. The Buddha had this one talk where he said, a monk should always ask themselves, is there anything that I'm doing now that someone else who was wise would criticize me for? Or can I myself criticize myself? Is there anything I can say about myself that I know is wrong and I'm still doing it? And we should be able to compare this with the things that we know and the things that we teach to others. We should ask ourselves, have I actually gained anything from this practice, such that if someone asked me later on, what have you gained, you wouldn't be ashamed and you wouldn't have to lie or make stuff up or admit that you haven't done anything, you haven't gained anything. So we should always be clear that what is the truth? What is the truth in our practice? What is the truth of reality? But what is the truth for us in our experience? And this doesn't make the truth subjective, but it requires us to conform our subjective experience to the truth that we understand. And the example, of course, that I'm thinking of, it's not why I want to talk about truth, actually. It just happens, you know, I have to work these things in somehow, is this this problem that I had this morning. Because we have this text, which obviously talks about the path of purifying your mind and letting go and giving up, and has all sorts of good and useful quotes in this regard in it. And then we have an argument about who gets to distribute the work. And who has some kind of ownership over the work. Which, in fact, you know, I shouldn't really be complaining because the work in question has been made free, made available for free, which is really a wonderful thing. From a technical standpoint, the problem is that it's very difficult in the format that it's in to copy and paste. And of course, it's a proprietary format, so there are many places that it can't be used, many format, many ways that it won't be able to be used and spread. It can't be indexed on Google, for example, for people to find. It isn't in Unicode and so on. So it's more of a technical argument. But actually, there's a great thing here being done here, is that it has been offered for free. But nonetheless, there's this idea of clinging and ownership, and even a potential fight, you know, a potential battle brewing, which probably won't come to be. I'm not going to play chicken. Eventually, I'll just give in and keep to myself. But in the meantime, It really makes you think, or these sorts of things, whether this is a good example or not, it makes you, you know, you, this is really what I've been thinking about for the past little while, is on, you know, is our practice really in line with our preaching, in line with that, I mean, what we know? And it's so easy, so many people in this country and in other Buddhist countries have learned so much about the Buddha's teaching. And so many, I see people from non-Buddhist countries coming to Buddhism and diving headfirst into the texts and the scriptures. And there's a real caution that needs to be given there, is that, look at the people who have, there's people who are brilliant in the scriptures and yet are unable to put them into practice and have not gotten very far in the practice. So we should be clear with ourselves how our lives are paralleling or perpendicularing the things that we know and look up to, because the important thing is the truth. This is what the word Dhamma, or the word Dhamma, could mean. It could mean truth. We have the word also Satcha, the four Arya Satcha. This is probably the best translation, or the best word to be translated as truth, is Satcha. The Chattaro Arya Satchani, Chattari Arya Satchani. It's a neutral, neuter now. Chattari Arya Satchani. The Four Noble Truths. No, this is another important point, is that often we put these words up as catchphrases, you know, like the word, the Four Noble Truths are probably the best example. So whenever you pick up a book about Buddhism, this is what you get on the first page. The Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths. Life is suffering. Just the introduction to Buddhism. What did the Buddha teach? Life is suffering. I don't know if you've heard me say, but it's kind of an obstinate thing to say, but the Buddha never taught that life is suffering. As far as I know, there's no one instance of the Buddha's teaching says life is suffering. It's a horrible thing to say and a horrible way to present your teaching. Life is suffering. And it really is quite meaningless, in fact. Because life is just a concept, and it's something that, of course, is full of many pleasures, and it's full of many pains. No, the first noble truth is that there is suffering. Never said life is suffering. The first noble truth is that there is suffering. Well, basically, in fact, it doesn't even say that. The first noble truth is that birth is suffering, old age is suffering, death is suffering. Nowhere does it say life is suffering. Birth is suffering. Well, that just means, you know, when mother gives birth, and I was thinking about this recently, could you imagine having to give birth to a child? It's apparently quite painful. But it can also be suffering because of being born into this birth or that birth. But basically here it means birth is, you know, being, the act of being born can be quite painful. In most cases, as a human being anyway, is quite painful. Old age is suffering, that needs no explanation. Death can be great suffering. And I think it's more important to say can be, because these are all just examples that the Buddha gave, and they aren't literal definitions. The literal definition of the Buddha is that anything that is clung to, anything that you cling to, this is a source of suffering. That the five kinds of clinging, and the five upadana kandha, the five aggregates of clinging, or the five aggregates that we cling to, are suffering. Or these five aggregates, when clung to, are suffering. And there's an interesting, in the Visuddhimagga, this book that we're talking about, he gives an interesting simile. He says, just like a person who sees some fire, if you see these three big fires off in the distance, or in front of you even, you can say, you can be sure to yourself that if someone jumps into one of those fires, they're going to meet with a lot of great suffering. But it doesn't mean that you're suffering standing there looking at the fires. And this is the key, that these things are, the point of the word dukkha or suffering is not that they have to be that way. It's that they're sharp and painful. There's something like a knife. When you grab it, you get cut. Doesn't mean that there's any problem with the knife. Just don't grab it by the blade. So that's why the Buddha uses the word upadana kanta. Right through the clinging, these aggregates become suffering. So that's the Buddha's teaching on truth. That was one point I wanted to make. And the other point is that as I think many Buddhist teachers have said, this shows the pointed nature of the Buddha's teaching, that the Buddha didn't teach everything. He didn't have a word to put in for every aspect of existence. So on the one hand, we have to understand that we're trying to get to the truth. But on the other hand, we have to understand that there's a specific truth or set of truths that we're trying to come to. We're not trying to understand everything about the universe, and oftentimes we have to give up our seeking and our searching, and there's many spiritual goals that we may have to put aside, and we would put aside when we realize that actually they are not important. There's a story of a monk who, an ascetic who flew through the air, flew through the universe, made a mind, got an out-of-body experience where he flew through the universe trying to find the end of the universe. And then he died, because he kept flying and flying and couldn't find the end. And then he came back as an angel and came to see the Buddha and said what he'd done. And the Buddha said, oh, you can't find the end of the universe that way. He said, but the end of the universe is here within you. It's within this 6 foot by 2 foot by 1 foot frame. There's the beginning of the universe and the end of the universe. And this is really how the Buddhist teaching works, is that we're the truth that we need is within ourselves. We don't need to look outside, and we don't need to chase after truths, chase after the whole truth. It should be nothing but the truth, but it doesn't have to be the whole truth. There are aspects of truth that we may never come to understand, may never come to know. But what is important is that we come to understand our experience, and we come to understand the workings of this cycle of suffering. How does suffering work? How does the one thing that's preventing us from finding peace and happiness, how does it work? Disassemble it, break it apart. Once you understand it, don't put it back together again. Simple. Something like that. Once we understand how it works, once we've disassembled it, then it can't hurt us. This is really the key. It's like a machine of sorts. All you have to do is disassemble it. But the reason why it works is that the reason why it works like a machine is that once you disassemble it, you understand it. And then the beginning comes, your reactions change. It's like that movie Groundhog Day, where just eventually Bill Murray starts to look and starts to see. He realizes. You know, he does everything the con artist way, and he even gets this woman, and but it's all totally fake. And then finally, you know, he realizes this, and he realizes what a jerk he's been, and he just acts normal. He gives up, he lets go, and his mind becomes much purer than before as a result. And so this day, if you've never seen this movie, it's Groundhog Day. It happens over and over again to this guy, and every day he wakes up and it's Groundhog Day, and he keeps doing things. He's a real jerk, and he does all sorts of mean and nasty things, and he keeps coming back till finally he gives it all up, and he realizes how much happier he is, you know, doing things in a nice way. It's kind of like the Christmas Carol, a Christmas Carol in a sense. But he gets a chance to do it all over, and finally in the end he does it in a good way, and then I can't remember what happens. I think he breaks free, and it's not Groundhog Day. But he changes, and really that's how this process works, that we come back again and again and again to the same things, and we keep banging our heads against the wall, we keep reacting in the same way, until finally we realize, we wake up, we break it apart, and we understand how it works, and we say, oh, wait, when I do this, it leads me to suffering. When I do this, it causes me pain and agony and stress. When I don't do that, I feel much better. And so the next time it comes around, you act in a different way. That's all there is to it. It's quite simple. It's nothing mystical about the Buddha's teaching. It's quite down to earth, I think. I wanted to write a book. I didn't want to write a book. I said if I ever write a book, it would be, I forget when it would be. Down to Earth Buddhism. I can't remember. It was a really good title, but I forgot it now. Anyway, I'm going on. That's what I had to talk about today. I hope that's been of some benefit. And thank you all for joining. It's great to see we have 9 of us here today. Thanks everyone for coming out, and let's try to keep this up. And thank you all for participating in the question and answer forum and the Buddhist social network, and for just in general supporting the spread of the Buddhist teaching. It's our practice and our good intentions. to help others and just, you know, to teach and to even to share the Dhamma with others. This is what is most important. This is the Buddha said, Dhammacari sukhangseti asmin loke paramicha. A person who practices the Dhamma finds happiness in this life, and when they die, they find happiness in the next life. So, for all of us, that isn't the most important. Our most important is that we let go, and whether it's this life or the next life, we will always be happy and at peace. So again, thank you all for tuning in, and all the best.